Let me open up a prayer and we'll get started. Lord, we thank you for this day. Thank you for this time. I pray that you would just bless it, help this time to be helpful for us, Lord, as we walk and interact in this world around us. In your name I pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, so the next chapter I skipped. So you got the name of it. I skipped the one on evolution because we had talked about it, the clues of God. I'm going to the knowledge of God. And the knowledge of God has a little bit of overlap with what we talked about earlier with C.S. Lewis, but it's still got some different points of view, and I thought it was interesting. I'm going to review the clues of God section real briefly. And basically, he had three points in that chapter. One was, this has to do with evolution giving us clues for God. And one was the existence of the universe, the fact that it started, and the fine-tuning requiring Earth and us to survive is a clue. The fact that, you know, everything's absolutely perfect on this world, and that was required for us to survive. The second one is the clue of beauty. If there is no God, then everything's meaningless, and there would be no beauty. Nothing would be, it would be good or bad. I mean, if there's no standard, it would just be just why do we have these degrees of things that we're drawn to that are beautiful and things that are not? And then the last point, which was his strongest point, was that the fact that God, the idea of God permeates society, points to there being a God. And you have to understand that evolution, if it's naturalistic and true in what it teaches, that there is no God and that we randomly got here by just molecules bumping into one another, then everything that you do and think is a result of evolution. And the stuff that did not help you survive or the human race to survive would have gone away. And so the fact that 95% of the world believes in a God of some sort, now a lot of them are wrong about what they believe, but that points to the fact that if that didn't exist, why did that trait continue to exist? Why would we continue to believe in God if there is no God? What evolutionary benefit is there for us for that? And there is none. And so that was basically his chapter, had to do with the fact that the universe is fine-tuned, the clue of beauty, and the fact that the idea of God permeates society. So back to this chapter, dealing with the knowledge of God. He speaks how many conservatives complain. And this book is written 20 years ago, so a little less than 20 years ago. So a lot's changed. He speaks how many conservatives complain that young people are a culture are relativistic and amoral. And I think this has to do with mostly sexual morality, probably a lot of this, about things just aren't the way they used to be. Keller, doesn't find this to be true, dealing with young New Yorkers for many, many years. He states that the secular young have a very, very fine sense of right and wrong. Now, their right and wrong emphasis may be different than ours or someone else's, but they have a very strong idea of what's right and wrong. I would say now, since this book has been written with cancel culture, they have become, they make fun of the Puritans. Now they are the Puritans because if you don't believe what they believe, you're canceled, you're gone. And if you said something 20 years ago that was offensive, you're canceled. So they're very moralistic, very puritanical in that sense. They're more puritanical than the Puritans. And so this idea is out there. There is morality out there amongst the world and the lost. He states at one time a young couple came to him for spiritual direction. They told him, "We really don't believe in much of anything. And how could they even begin to figure out if there was a God?" they said. He asked them about something what they thought was really wrong. In other words, he said, "What do you think is really wrong? Something that's really bad?" And the wife said, she was against practices that marginalized women. And he agreed with that and said, since he was a Christian who believed God had made all humans, but he was curious to why she thought that was wrong. So the Bible teaches us that we're all humans, we're all made in the image of God, men and women are equal. Why would you believe that since you don't believe in a God? And her response was that everyone knows it's wrong to violate the rights of someone else. And his response to her was, "Well, most people in the world don't know that. They don't have Western human rights." He said next, "Imagine if someone said everyone knows women are inferior you'd say, that's not an argument, that's an assertion. And you would be right. So start again. If there is no God, and you believe and everyone evolved from animals, would it be wrong to trample on someone's rights? If there's no God, we just came from animals. The husband then said, well, we're just bigger-brained animals. But I'd say animals have rights, too. You shouldn't trample on the rights of animals, either. So Keller said if he held stronger animals guilty for violating the rights of weaker animals. So when the lion chases and eats the gazelle, is the lion trampling on the gazelle's rights? Well, I would say he was, because the gazelle was minding his own business eating grass. Now, if it was a deer eating my stuff, the lion can have at him. So he asked, is he violating the rights? And they said, no, he can't say that animals violate rights. So he only held human beings guilty if they trampled on the weak. Yes. Why the double standard? Why can't humans do what the rest of the animal kingdom does? Why did this couple insist that humans had this great, unique individual dignity and worth? And why do they believe in human rights? Well, the woman ultimately said, I don't know. And I guess they're there. That's all. I think I've told you this. I had a similar interaction with a guy years ago where I was trying to lead him to the road about, because he said there's no ultimate right and wrong. And I would say, well, is it okay to murder someone? And this guy, he's a doctor, he'd say, yeah, you know, you can't do that. I said, well, why can't you murder someone? And he would say, well, you can't take the right. It's wrong to take someone else's life away from them without their consent or whatever. I said, well, why is that wrong? Well, because they have rights to live and breathe and enjoy their life just like you do. I said, but why is that? And we just kept on going down this road. I mean, why? Why? And then finally at the end of it, he says, well, it just is. I said, that's it? It just is? I mean, but that's how most people live. They don't think about what they really believe. And that's Keller's point here. So he states, so with this couple, they had laughed at some of their lame responses, and they were open to exploration and encouraged them to be more pointed. That encouraged Keller to be more pointed than he usually would. I was more pointed and got into a fight, but that's okay. Here's the point, and it has changed. As the people from older generations, the people of this generation have strong moral conviction, but they have no basis for their conviction. We are in a post-Christian society, clearly a post-truth society. It's as if their moral intuitions are free-floating in midair, far off the ground. Now, I have several quotes, just the way it's going to work out for this chapter. It's got several quotes to read. This is the first one by Polish poet Miloš. And this is what he says. What has been surprising in the post-Cold War period are those beautiful and deeply moving words pronounced with veneration in places like Prague and Warsaw, words which pertain to the old repertory of the rights of man and the dignity of the person. I wondered this phenomenon because maybe underneath there is an abyss. After all, those ideas have their foundation in religion, and I am not over-optimistic about the survival of a religion in a scientifically technological civilization. Notions that seemed buried forever have suddenly been resurrected. But how long can they stay afloat if the bottom is taken out? In other words, how long can we have morals if we have no reason for our morals or religion? Keller doesn't agree with him, and he thinks that people will definitely go on holding to their beliefs in human dignity even when their conscious belief in God is gone. He has a radical thesis, and he believes people in our culture know unavoidably there is a God, but they are repressing what they know. And so Keller's point is that everybody, even the liberal, even the most atheistic, knows there's a God, but is mentally arguing against it. And I think if you've ever talked to an atheist and brought up the point, and I've had this happen several times, where I bring up the point, and I've said this before about, well, then there's no right or wrong because there's no God. And then they say, wait a minute, you're saying I don't have any morals? I've had them say this several times. No, that's not what I said. I said, you have no reason to have your morals. You have them, but you have no reason. And they just don't get it. The ones I've met don't get it. So Keller goes on to speak of the concept of a moral obligation. Again, and we have to keep in your mind, there is no God. We've all evolved here out of, you know, the zoo, the goo, the zoo, and you. You know, just there's no reason for us to be here at all. We just kind of evolved out of animals. There's no God. Okay, you just got to keep that in your mind. And so everything we do is based on evolutionary advancement. That's the only reason you do what you do. The reason I play golf, for some reason, is that it helps me evolve. I've evolved. I don't understand it, but that's what they're saying. Whatever hobby you have or whatever you're drawn to, there's an evolutionary purpose behind it. I can understand gardening. We got to eat. Common phrase, no one should impose their moral views on others because everyone has the right to find truth inside of him or herself. Again, this is an older book, just 15 years old, but I'd say a lot of this is kind of passé now because you're not allowed to have your own views, or they'll, you know, you're hung out to dry. But there is a sort of a sense in that if you talk to people. Then he says, but aren't there people in the world, when someone says this, that you have no right to put your views on someone else, aren't there people in the world doing things you believe that are wrong? Things that they should stop doing no matter what they personally believe about the correctness of the behavior. If you do, and everybody does, doesn't that mean you do believe there's some kind of moral standard that people should abide by regardless of their individual convictions? Why is it impossible in practice for anyone to be consistent moral relativist even when they are claimed to be? Because we all have pervasive, powerful, unavoidable belief not only in moral values, but also in moral obligation. I'm going to read a quote again. Moral is an orientation toward understanding about what is right and wrong, just and unjust, that there is not established by our own actual desires or preferences, but instead they believe to exist apart from them, providing a standard by which our desires and preferences can themselves be judged. So all people have moral feelings. Everybody does. Even the worst prisoner, you know, has moral feelings. There are people who get, you know, when they go to prison, they, because of their particular crime, they're in a lot of danger. And everyone has a conscience. And we tend to refrain when considering from doing something that we think is wrong. So you and I, even as believers in Christ and trying to be sanctified, will come to a decision, we'll come to a point where we can do something that we know is wrong and is right, and we feel this fight within us about whether or not we should do it, and we don't want to do the one that's wrong. Romans 7 says oftentimes we end up doing it, but that's not for this lesson. It doesn't stop there. It also believes our standards that exist apart from us, which we evaluate our moral feelings. This was Lewis's point. This is what brought Lewis to the point of Christianity, is the fact that he had this thing in him that was constantly, he was measuring himself up to something constantly, and he was always falling short. And he was wondering, where did that come from? Moral obligation is a belief that some things ought not to be done regardless of how a person feels about them within themselves, regardless of what the rest of the community or culture says, whether or not there is or self-interest. And that's the key, self-interest. Because if evolution is true, self-interest is the overall arching concept, survival of the fittest. It's all about your survival, what's best for you. And moral obligation sometimes, and oftentimes, is a result of you doing something that's against your self-interest. And so the question is, where does that come from if we just came from apes? The earlier young couple had no doubts that people in other cultures should honor women's rights. In actual practice, all people treat some principles as absolute standards by which we judge the behavior of those we don't share that don't share our values. No matter how much his example is, we always like to go back to the Nazis, that's what my dad would say. No matter how much we thought the Nazis thought it was right to exterminate the Jews, we don't care. It doesn't matter how sincerely they held those beliefs, it was wrong. Right? And so now we have this idea that we're going to morally judge previous generations for the stuff they did wrong, even though we didn't live then and we don't know what it was like to be then and we didn't grow up in their environment and all that. But we have this sense of condemning people who lived before us for whatever they did, whether it was imperialism, colonialism, slavery, whatever. Pick your ism. humanity does not just have moral feelings. They also have an understanding that moral standards exist outside of us by which our internal moral feelings are evaluated. So we have these standards. We know they're out there. Yours may be a little bit different than your neighbor's, but you compare yourself to these standards constantly. So what is the evolutionary theory of moral obligation? So an evolutionist that doesn't believe in a God, why would he believe that we have moral ideas and concepts? Their view is that altruistic people, those that act unselfishly and cooperatively, survived in greater number than those who were selfish and cruel, which makes complete no sense. Makes no sense. That the cruel ones, I'm not saying, you're in a tribe of barbarians, and you're cruel, and you want your neighbor's land because they have better farmland. Do you think the people over there catching butterflies and singing songs with their flutes are going to survive your onslaught as you are cruel and vicious to them and you destroy them? Who's going to survive that? Well, of the two, the people over there catching butterflies and singing and dancing, or the warriors with spears and shields and all kinds of weapons? But anyway, the theory is that being altruistic made you survive more, and these genes were passed down to a greater degree, so we're now altruistic because it somehow helped us. And now most of us, because of this, believe that unselfish behavior is right because it helped us evolve to where we are. There's many flaws in this theory. Being sacrificial may benefit one family or even an extended clan and therefore result in more descendants. So in other words, if you have a clan or a family, as a parent, if you're going to be a good parent, you have to sacrifice, as I'm sure you know. You have to give things up that you could spend on yourselves. You have to invest your time in your children, not in yourselves. You are sacrificial, and that does help your descendants grow. However, the opposite response, hostility to all people outside of one's group, should be considered moral and right behavior. So if my neighbor wants my plot of land, I can't be sacrificial to him because I've got to survive. And so you've got this conflict that develops. And that's what all of life is. I mean, it's until Christianity civilized Western civilization and Western civilization spread, that's how we got to where we are. You know, the Jim Elliot story we talked about a couple weeks ago, John did. You know, when those guys were trying to meet those Indians down in Peru and they're doing all these things, if you've read that book, and they're delivering them gifts and presenting them with gifts and trying to witness to them, and then eventually they decided we're going to try to meet them. And they meet these guys, and what do? They just spear them all to death. They just kill them. And then later on, Elizabeth Elliot, Jim's wife, went to live with them. And, it came out, why did you do that? And because we were afraid of them. We thought they were going to take our stuff and kill us. That's how people act, right? I mean, that's our natural inclination. They're hostile. And don't ask any questions, just kill them, and then we win. And so that would be considered moral behavior because by killing Jim Elliot and his men, you are protecting your people. And so that's not altruistic. That's not self-sacrificing. That's the other. Nowadays, we believe that sacrificing all, even life, for those outside of one's clan or group is right. So, you know, now we think sacrifice for even someone that, you know, love your enemy as yourself, even someone that you don't know, you may sacrifice. You drive down the road, you see someone, you don't know this person, pulled over and they're in trouble, you help them. Or you're in a situation and, you know, something bad happens to somebody, you try to help them. It doesn't benefit me at all, it doesn't benefit you, but yet we all have this pull to do that. And if evolution is responsible for how we got here, why would we have that desire? That doesn't preserve my family, me. That doesn't help me. It inconveniences me. I got things to do. If we see a stranger in trouble and we try to help, and we may feel guilty if we don't help. Just drive right on by. See a pal. Hope you figure it out. He's got a cell phone. How could such a trait be passed down through an evolutionary process? Such people would have been less likely to survive and pass on their genes. So your gene, you got to think like them. Everything you do is based on your DNA. If you have an X and an X, you're a girl. And if you have an X and a Y, you're a boy. Now, I don't care what you think. If you think you're a giraffe, you're not a giraffe. You're a person. Anyway, so your DNA is inside of you. And according to evolution, it directs everything you do. Why you came in and got whatever you got off the food bar and drank whatever you drank is an evolutionary process that your genes told you to do. That's their theory. And so if you pull over to help someone, that's a genetic thing that you've inherited because that helps you to survive. That doesn't help you to survive. Why is that there? Why is that there? Because really, if people were out sacrificing themselves for strangers, they would be less likely to pass their genes on to their descendants because they wouldn't be here to pass them on. So on the principle of strict evolutionary naturalism, altruism should have died out with the human race long ago. Instead, Keller states, it is stronger than ever. Evolution has no means of which the origin of our moral feelings, let alone the idea that we all believe that there are external moral standards by which moral feelings are evaluated. It's not that we have these moral inclinations to help people, sacrificial and all this. It's that, as Lewis talked about, we are constantly judging ourselves with this. Even unbelievers are. I shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. I ought to have done this. I should have done this. Oh, I could have helped. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, everybody talks about this. So the problem of moral obligation. The concept of moral obligation creates a problem for those with a secular understanding of the world. He quotes an anthropologist called Carolyn Fleur Loben. She was an anthropologist in a field that is dominated by cultural relativism. All moral beliefs are culturally created. So your morals are not because of God, it's because your culture, which is basically a way of saying you evolved it. And you have no basis for judging one culture against another. All cultures are equal. We're all the same. There's no one culture that's better than another. Kumbaya. But she was appalled by practices in some societies she was studying that oppressed women. So she'd go to these different cultures, and there they, you know, women had zero rights. They were basically owned by the men. They could be beaten up, whatever. The man was in full charge. And she was offended by this. And she decided to promote women's interest in the societies that she worked where they didn't have a high view of woman. But then she knew that her views were created by a Northern European individualistic mode of thought. And I would say they're caused by a Northern European heavily influenced by Christianity. But, you know, we don't want to talk about that. So what right did she have to impose her cultural views that women should be treated equally on these other cultures? What right did she have to do this? Another quote. Anthropologists continue to express strong support for cultural relativism. One of the most contentious issues arises from the fundamental question, what authority do we Westerners have to impose our own concept of universal rights on the rest of humanity? But the cultural relativist argument is often used by repressive governments to deflect international criticism of their abuse of their citizens. I believe that we should not let the concept of relativism stop us from using national and international forums to examine ways to protect the lives and dignity of people in every culture. When there is a choice between defending human rights and defending cultural relativism, anthropologists should choose to protect and promote human rights. We cannot be bystanders. And so you understand the conundrum they're in. You understand that they have no reason to believe what they believe. There's no reason whatsoever. So their mouths and their brains talk one way, but their hearts and who they are know it should not be that way. And so there's this disconnect between the two. And the question is, if all cultures are relative, then so is the idea of universal human rights. So how can I decide to impose my values on a culture? Who are you to come in here and tell us that? And the funny thing is, you know, that's the same exact thing, you know, when they're mad about. You ever talk to someone from England, they're not very happy or proud of the British Empire during the Queen Victoria's age, where they went all over and the sun never set on the British Empire. They're sort of ashamed of that. And there's many, many reasons they did it. They did it for financial. They did it because they wanted to rule the world. They did it for spiritual reasons. You know, they did it. A lot of them did it because they thought they were civilizing the savage. Piba. They were spreading the gospel. They go into India and they spread the gospel. They go into Africa and they spread the gospel. But there was, people were exploited. People were killed. Lots of bad things happened, but lots of good things happened. But yet, so they're against that. But they're okay with them going in and telling these places like in Saudi Arabia that you shouldn't treat women that way. Or in wherever. You understand? So they're allowed to put their views, but don't spread the gospel and put your views. Because their views are right. But the ironic thing is, we believe, if we spread the gospel, that we believe that there is a God and we're trying to tell them the good news. They say there is no good news. There is no overarching moral superiority, right and wrong. But then I've got to tell you it. So there's a disconnect. Oppression is a concept of Western civilization. She wants to stop the oppression in other cultures, and therefore our values really are better than theirs. In other words, if it's wrong to oppress people, and we know that because we're Westerners, and other cultures oppress people, our values are better than theirs. But yet that goes against the whole cultural relativism of most of the world, that there is no such thing as one superior culture to another. So you understand the problem they're in, the disconnect? And this is Keller's point. They know there's a God in their heads, or in their hearts, I should say. But they don't want to believe the implications of that, so they have this disconnect where the two are separate. They have heavy, heavy moral obligations. This is wrong, but there's no reason for it. Don't you dare say there's one God who overrules the world. And so this applies to human rights. Flor Loban is struggling with a major crisis in the field of human rights. The concept of human rights is the only thing we can use against oppressive regimes throughout the world, Asia, Africa, and South America. And so there's a lawyer, an attorney, Michael J. Perry, defines human rights as the twofold conviction that every human being has inherent dignity and that it is obligatory that we order our lives in accordance with this fact. But the question is, why should we believe that? Where does this dignity come from? Alan Dershowitz wrote an article which says, where do rights come from? He lays out three possibilities. One, God. People are made in God's image. And every human is sacred and inviolable. Ding, 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 ding. I like that one. He rejects this since millions of people are agnostic, which is kind of, I don't get that, you know, just because this is a ruler, right? This is a ruler. 1 foot is this long, it's got 12 inches. This is the standard. Well, just because you don't believe in my ruler doesn't make my ruler not true, right? I mean, so anyway. So that's Alan Dershowitz's first argument, that where do rights come from? Two, they come from nature. However, he points out that nature thrives on violence and predation, survival of the fittest. There's no way that dignity come from that. The third view is created by us, by laws. In other words, we create right and wrong. We create moral obligation. We create human dignity. The majority. Well, what happens if the majority decides not to grant human rights to a minority? Does that make it right? Of course not. Quote again that I will read. Dershowitz quoted Ronald Dworkin, who argued that this third view of human rights is also inadequate, that we create them. It is no answer to say that if an individual has these rights, then the community is better off in the long run. Because when we say someone has a right to speak his mind freely, we mean he is entitled to do this, even if it would not be in the general interest. And so that doesn't work either. If human rights are created by majorities, what use are they? Rights cannot be created. They must be discovered or they have no value. One author, Dworkin, also states we must find something beyond utility that argues for these rights. What could that be? And neither Dershowitz or Dworkin gave an answer. Years ago, I read an article in the Atlanta paper on a weekend, and it talked about this big article, how we need to create a new myth. We need a myth that we can all believe in so we all do the right thing. we need something because we don't have anything because we realize that we just got here randomly by accident through years and years and years of random mutations, blah, blah, blah. But we can't get along because we need to make something up phony so that we all do the right thing. Law professor Michael Perry states there is religious ground for morality of human rights, but it's far from clear that there are non-religious grounds for human rights. And if there is no God, any and all morality of love and human rights is completely baseless. There's no reason to have them. There's no reason to be kind. There's no reason to be loving. And there's no reason to work for peace. Basically, we have moral judgments, and we have no reason for them. And that's this disconnect between the heart, I would say, and the head, where the head doesn't want to believe there's a God, but the heart knows that there is this morality out there that we're comparing ourselves to. So we get the grand says who. And this is sort of like the guy that I was talking to. It just is. It's just right. It's just wrong. You can't do that. It just is. It just is. It just is. This is a great just is.
Not the great I am.
No, that's right. That's right. The great it is. So Yale professor Arthur Lestat says this. When would it be permissible to make the formal intellectual equivalent of what is known in the bar rooms and schoolyards as the grand says who, in the absence of God? Each ethical and legal system will be differentiated by the answer it chooses to give to one key question. Who among us ought to be able to declare law that ought to be obeyed? Stated that baldly, the question is so intellectually unsettling that one would expect to find a noticeable number of legal and ethical thinkers trying not to come to grips with it. Either God exists or he does not. But if he does not, nothing and no one else can take his place. If there is no God, then there is no way to say to any other action is either immoral or another one is moral. It's only, and this is Lewis's point, it's only that I like this. I like it when people are nice to each other, but it doesn't matter. Again, going back to Francis Schaeffer, he says you're driving down the road and there's an old lady on the side of the road. It could be a young lady. It could be any lady. It could be a man. It could be who. Anyway, you got three options. You can drive by him, you can run him over, or you can stop and help him. All three. If there is no God, all three are equal. There's no difference. She's just a blob of molecules. Who cares? She gets put back in the dirt and, you know, mushrooms will come up in her body and feed a couple of vultures. It'll be good for society. So who gets to put these subjective feelings into law? If there's no God, who gets to make these choices? Who gets to put what they feel into law? The majority? Does that mean they can vote to exterminate the minority? We don't like that. That's not good. If you say no, you're back to square one. Who says that's wrong? If there's no God, then all moral statements are arbitrary. All moral values are subjective and internal, and there's no standard by which to judge a person's feelings and values. Left ends his essay this way. As things are now, everything is up for grabs. Nevertheless, napalming babies is bad, starving the poor is wicked, buying and selling each other is depraved. There is such a thing as evil. Altogether now, says who? God help us. And so, if there is no God, who are you to say it's wrong to napalm babies or buy your neighbor and sell them? Who? Who says if there's no God? Leff, as others, is pointing out that despite the fact that we can't justify or ground human rights in the world without God, we still know they exist. Without God, he can't justify moral obligation, and yet he can't know it exists. And so, the idea that Keller's point is that all mankind knows there's God out there. They hide from it, they deny it, they separate it in their brain. But it's like if you said, I don't believe in gravity, but you refuse to jump off a building. It's the same thing. One's more painful than the other one, but it's the same principle. You've got these laws that you're following in your life, and the whole time you don't acknowledge that they're laws. Gravity's just for you. Gravity's not for me. I don't believe in gravity. No one does that. So the argument for God from the argument for God from the violence of nature. Annie Dillard lived for a year by a creek in the mountains of Virginia, expecting to be inspired and refreshed by the closeness to nature. She probably didn't smell too good either. Instead, she came to realize that nature is completely ruled by one central principle: violence by the strong against the weak. Another quote. There's not a person in the world that behaves as badly as a praying mantis. But wait, you say, there's no right or wrong in nature. Right and wrong is a human concept. Precisely. We are moral creatures in an amoral world. Or consider the alternative. It is only human feeling that is freakishly amiss. All right, then, it is our emotions that are amiss. We are freaks. The world is fine, and let us all go have lobotomies to restore us to our natural state. We can leave lobotomized, go back to the creek, and live on the banks as untroubled as any muskrat or reed. You first. So she saw all of nature is based on violence. Just hang around and watch stuff, you know? Watch your praying mantis eat its... I guess they eat their husbands, don't they? That's kind of scary. They just do it. Honey, thank you for the help. I'm going to have the babies. I'm having you for dinner. You know, Black Widow. Yet, we believe it's wrong for wives to eat their husbands. No ideas. I'm tough. I'm gamey. And we believe it's wrong for stronger human individuals to kill weaker ones. If violence is totally natural in the world, if the rest of the world runs by nature, you ever seen a cat catch a mouse? I mean, they just love torturing the poor thing. Or the rabbit? I had one fat cat and one skinny cat. The skinny cat would catch the rabbit, and then the fat one would come up. They're like Wild Kingdom coming up through the yard. You know, the little cat, he's got the rabbit, and the other one's walking by. He's like, what did you do? And then they sit around, and they just put the rabbit in the middle, and they watch it. And he tries to get away, and they trap it. I mean, it's cruel. It's horrible. If I did that to somebody, I'd be in jail. Hey, Pete, let's go catch somebody and beat them up and watch them try to get away and then beat them again. So why is it wrong for us to trample on the weak if it's okay for nature? If we're just, I'm just a part of nature. Kumbaya. There is no, listen to this, this is kind of tricky. There is no basis for moral obligation unless we argue that nature is unnatural. You got that? Nature's the one that's messed up. We're the ones that are right because whatever reason. We can't judge nature as wrong unless there is some kind of God or supernatural standard apart from nature. Again, Lewis's point, there's got to be something that's above nature that we're comparing it to say that it's wrong. There would have to be a God or divine order outside of nature to make that judgment. And there's only one way out of this. Pick up a Bible and see how it explains our moral sense better than the secular view. Again, this goes back to Schaeffer's point, is that what we believe is the most reasonable of all the other options. And again, I want you to realize, too, that the Bible is a unique book. There are no other sacred writings that are, people like to lump them, but they're not lumpable. They're not in the same category. There's nothing else like the Bible. It is unique when you compare it to the writings of Hinduism, when you compare it to the Quran, when you compare it to the Book of Mormon, which is basically a perversion. It's unique, and it explains the situation we're in precisely. That makes sense. If the world was made by a God of peace, justice, and love, then that is why we know that violence and oppression and hate are wrong. If the world is fallen, broken, and needs to be redeemed, that explains the violence and the disorder we see. If you believe human rights are reality, then it makes much more sense that God exists than he does not. If you do not believe in God and remain secular, the conclusion is obvious. There is no basis for morality, human rights that we experience. There's no reason for you to act the way you want to act. Your brain is completely disconnected from your heart. You intellectually, you say there's no God, yet your heart pulls you to do these things and to compare yourself and to do right. The endless, pointless litigation of existence. Let's get further in where this goes. You just got to keep going. The point is not to prove the existence of God. The point is to demonstrate that everyone already knows God exists. Without God, all moral choices are meaningless. All life is meaningless. Another quote from the playwright Arthur Miller in the play After the Fall. There's a character named Quentin, and he says this. For many years, I looked at life as a case at law. It was a series of proofs. When you're young, you prove how to be brave or smart, and then what a good lover, and then a good father, and finally how wise or powerful or whatever. But underlying all of it, I see now there was a presumption that one moved on an upward path towards some elevation where, God knows what, I would be justified or condemned. A verdict anyway. I think now that my disaster really began when I looked up one day and I saw that the bench was empty. What he means by that is that the judicial bench is empty. There's no judge. There's no God. So he's living his life, learning to be brave, learning to do all these things, make himself a good name, and he's thinking he's going to be judged. But then he looks up in his mind, and there's nobody to judge him. There's no judge in sight. And all that remained was an endless argument with oneself, this pointless litigation of existence before an empty bench, which, of course, is another way of saying despair. What does he say? That we believe peace is better than war, we believe that truth is better than lying, and we believe that care in nature is better than destroy. All of us believe that. Everybody does. Only sociopaths don't. That's a sociopath, someone who likes the bad, not the good. But when we live our life striving for these good things and at the end look to see the cosmic bench is empty, in other words, there's no God judging me whether I lied or told the truth, then you realize, why is one choice better than the other? What makes a difference? Who cares? Why would I care if I lie? Why would I even care if someone caught me in a lie and didn't like me anymore? Why do I care? If the cosmic bench is truly empty, then the entire span of human civilization, however how long that is, a couple million years, how long, will be an infinitesimal brief spark in relation to oceans of dead time that precedes it and follows it. That's kind of depressing. So you understand that, look, if there's no God and there's no judge, we're just, you know, we're on this earth for a few million years. We'll fizzle out and time just keeps going. Everything here is meaningless. There's no point to anything that we do. Nothing. So there's two options when we come to this conclusion. We can refuse to think about it and the implications, which is what most people do. We can live as our choices matter. Differences between love and cruelty, even when there isn't a difference. Doesn't matter if you help the lady on the side of the road or run her over. Doesn't matter, but you'll help her because whatever. You get the benefit of living as if there is a God without following it, because the bench isn't empty. So you live as if there is one. We all live like we're being judged, but there really isn't one. The second option is to recognize you do know there's a God, and you could accept the fact that you live as in beauty and love have meaning, and that there is meaning in life, and if human beings have inherent dignity because you know God exists. It is dishonest to live if he's there, and yet fail to acknowledge the one who has given you all these gifts. And so that's the conundrum they're in, those people that don't believe in God. Next few weeks, we're going to get more into specifically Christianity as we finish up the book. All right, let's pray. Lord, we thank you for this day. We thank you that you are there and that you have reached out to us, because without that, we wouldn't know you. I pray now for our worship service. May we worship you in spirit and truth. In your name I pray. Amen.